You're listening to the free edition of Sweden in Focus from The Local. If you would like to listen to a full-length version of the podcast, as well as an additional midweek episode, please check the episode notes for details on how to upgrade to Membership Plus. Here's this week's free edition.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Sweden in Focus, the Local's weekly news podcast. We are recording on Wednesday, the 1st of March, and on this week's episode, we're going to talk about Turkey resuming NATO talks with Sweden, but could Hungary put a spanner in the works? We'll discuss a controversial court ruling that has caused a lot of outrage in Sweden. We'll talk about the fallout after the Stockholm region's chief of police was found dead in his home last week. We'll look into why Sweden is still importing gas from Russia more than a year after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. We'll listen to an interview with the Australian ambassador to Sweden. And finally, we ask, just how important is it to learn Swedish if you plan to live in Sweden? I'm Paul O'Mahony, and with me today in Stockholm is James Savage, and we are joined from Skåne by Richard Orange and Emma Lovegreen. Hello, everybody.
And hello.
Hi.
Are you all nicely rested up after your break from the podcast last week?
Oh, yes. Very nice.
Good.
5 days in Paris. Can't beat it.
Oh, very nice.
And Paris. Meeting our lovely, lovely colleagues down there for the first time in ages, which was great. It was like being in an episode of Talking France. And if you want to experience it, I can highly recommend that you download the podcast when it comes back next week.
That was a really nice piece of advertising. Did any of you see the Northern Lights the other day that were visible all over Sweden, all the way down to Skåne?
No, I was asleep.
No. Totally missed it. I've seen them before, though. They are spectacular. It's when they come back, it's worth going out if you've got the opportunity.
I saw them for the first time.
Did you?
I did. I saw them for the first time ever, yeah. And I have a tip for anybody in Stockholm. It's to get away from the city lights. I headed to a place called Trintorp in Tyresö, which is when you're standing on the beach there, you're facing north. Mm. And yeah, I had a perfect view of them. Spectacular.
We've actually got an article on the site about like what to know about the Northern Lights and sort of how to know when you can see them next, like with links to great apps and things like that that will tell you exactly when there's a good chance of seeing the Northern Lights.
So it's gradually getting a bit less wintry in Sweden, and in fact, meteorologists are saying that spring has arrived in much of southern Sweden now, although not yet here in Stockholm. I think you've got spring in Skåne and in Gothenburg and other places quite far up the country. But one thing that definitely has arrived is the month of March, and we have an article on the site about some of the things that change in Sweden this month, which we'll link to in the notes. And that article includes things like how many lynx hunters are allowed to shoot and how alcohol prices are increasing this month. But it also focuses a bit on NATO, which we're going to give you some updates on now. We mentioned in the last episode that Turkey had signalled its willingness to reopen talks with Sweden. And next week, representatives from Turkey, Sweden and Finland are set to meet in Brussels. The outcome is uncertain, and Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu continues to insist that Sweden has not yet met all of Turkey's demands. And as we discussed last week, it's not inconceivable that Turkey could ratify Finland's application while keeping Sweden on hold. So first of all, Richard, is it true that Sweden hasn't done what it said it would in the trilateral memorandum?
I think it depends which side you talk to. I think the really tricky bits are what it committed to do in Sweden. So it committed to prevent the activities of the PKK, which is the Kurdish terror organisation. And what's tricky is it wasn't just members of the terror organisation, but also affiliated and inspired groups or networks, which is extremely vague and could basically mean almost anyone who's friendly to the Kurdish cause. And so President Erdogan has used that to basically come up with this big list of people he says are, you know, linked to or inspired by the PKK and demand that Sweden extradites them. And then that's the other bit that's tricky, is the extradition clause, because is that Sweden commits to handling extradition requests for people it suspects of terrorism and, quote, expeditiously and thoroughly taking account information, evidence and intelligence provided by Turkey. Next week, Sweden is going to bring in a new terror law which makes taking part in a terror group a crime and aiding a terror group. And that it will criminalise a lot of people who nowadays Sweden wouldn't be able to extradite. So it could be that Turkey will see that as a sign that Sweden is making an effort and perhaps use that as a pretext to give Sweden the go-ahead. But I wouldn't bet on it.
And Turkey is not the only country left to approve Sweden and Finland's NATO applications. The Hungarian parliament is expected to convene next week to potentially vote on whether to let the two Nordic nations into the defence alliance. How do we expect the vote to go, Richard? Is it going to be plain sailing in Budapest, or could there be choppy waters ahead there too?
Well, I mean, it's already looking unlikely that the vote's even going to go ahead next week, because Viktor Orban, Hungary's Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, Gergely Gulyás, he was saying on Saturday that, in fact, while the debate will happen this week, the actual vote could be pushed forward to March the 21st. So it looks like it's quite up in the air. And the focus has been entirely on Turkey and Turkey not ratifying it. And people have kind of taken Hungary for granted. And I think that's now looking like it might be a bit complacent, because last week, Viktor Orban, in a radio interview, was saying, it was a classic. He was like going, well, you know, I would love Sweden to join NATO, but many of the MPs in my party, they have their doubts, you know. And, you know, and after the lies that Sweden has said that we are, you know, undermining democracy in Hungary, you know, it's difficult for us to give the country their backing. And that, for me, sounds terrifying. I mean, I think that looks like they're getting ready to create some trouble at the last minute and try and get some concessions from the European Union and from Sweden and get people to back off and stop criticising Hungary for undermining democracy. I think it's going to be trickier than people assumed over the last year. On Saturday, Gulyás, the chief of staff, accused Sweden of slandering Hungary and making criticisms of its democracy that were unfounded, dishonest and unfair, and saying that joining NATO means Hungarian soldiers could be sent to protect Sweden in the event of an attack. And if that's the case, then Hungary needed more respect, and that there needs to be more talks between Sweden and Hungary before Hungary's MPs will be able to ratify Swedish membership. So it's not looking great, actually. It's looking like they've been keeping it quiet and then waiting for the last minute when they get maximum leverage. And now they're putting their foot down. So I think it's not going to be smooth sailing at all.
I don't know. Why is anybody surprised? I mean, this is Viktor Orban's Hungary. This is the big troublemaker in the EU. And why would they not make trouble for Sweden in a situation like this? It's for Orban, it's all about gaining leverage, just like it is for Erdogan.
Okay, thanks for that roundup. And we'll be following this story closely on the site in the weeks to come. One major talking point this week came after a court of appeal overruled a lower court that had found a man guilty of raping a 10-year-old girl. The new ruling was controversial because it turned on a question of semantics, specifically the meaning of the word snippa, which is a word used mostly by children to describe the female genitals. The court said it wasn't clear whether the word described the external visible parts of the genitals or the internal parts, and therefore it wasn't possible to be sure from the girl's testimony that the man had penetrated her with a finger. And this has sparked outrage on social media, and I read in the newspaper this morning that the parliamentary ombudsman has already received 80 complaints about the ruling. So I think that, you know, that we definitely haven't heard the last of this. Have you all been following this, and what do you make of it?
So the word snippa is relatively modern. It was launched like 10, 20 years ago as part of a campaign, really, because there wasn't a good children's word for the female genitals at the time.
Mm.
And part of the reason why they came up with this word was to give girls the language to use to describe if they had been sexually abused.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. It's maybe not the right word, but it's something that some people are still confused about exactly what the word means.
But if you zoom out, this is clearly a failure by the judicial system. Without necessarily saying that the court has made the wrong decision in the very narrow sense, it might have done. But there's no doubt that this girl was, at the very least, severely sexually assaulted or possibly raped.
Yeah.
And the idea that the fact that this man hasn't been convicted of anything at all is at some level has to be a failure of the judicial system. Now, then you can look at, well, was it right for the court in the very narrow instance to say that this was not rape? I mean, I think that's very questionable, clearly. If you look at the other evidence that this girl submitted, it seems clear that she was saying that the man had inserted his finger into her. And at the very least, that should be a severe sexual assault. Then there's a question, well, was it the fault of the prosecutor for not giving the court some alternative charges that it could convict this guy of? Was it, you know, of severe sexual assault rather than rape?
I've read the ruling and the girl, and like she also sort of showed with her hands and explained that he had sort of stuck a finger inside her. And the court, actually, like the appeals court also found the girl's story credible, and they believed that what she said had in fact happened. It was just a question of literally this one word, what does it mean?
Mm. Yeah, so they ended up consulting the dictionary.
Yeah.
And I was listening to Sveriges Radio have a new podcast that they just launched the other day, actually, called Dagens Eko, where they look at one story in detail every morning. And they had their own resident linguist on talking about it, and she seemed to suggest that this is a case where the dictionary hasn't kept pace with society, that anybody of a certain age, as you were talking about initially, Emma, that this was the word that was needed in the language for children in particular, and that children know what it means. And she said it means vagina, but the dictionary doesn't have that definition, and that's what the court leaned on in the end. They turned to the dictionary and they said, well, you know, the dictionary doesn't back up the girl's story.
Yeah, and it's like people are also pointing out that the only judge that had a dissenting opinion and thought that the man should actually be convicted, it was a woman in her 30s, whereas the other judges were all men in like their 60s or 70s or something like that. And of course you don't want to draw too many conclusions from that, but I know a lot of people have been saying that there's a petition out now saying that courts need to be, or the justice system in general, need more training in how to sort of deal with sexual assault, especially when it comes to children.
Just before we recorded last week's podcast, news came through that the Stockholm region's police chief, Mats Löfving, had been found dead at his home in Norrköping, just hours after a report was released that recommended the national police chief, Anders Thornberg, consider dismissing him over conflict of interest allegations in connection with an alleged romantic relationship with a colleague. And this is obviously a tragic story, and the police have come in for serious criticism for their handling of the internal investigation. Why are the police being criticised, Emma?
So they're being criticised for a few different reasons, really. First, that they launched an internal investigation at all, while there was also an ongoing criminal investigation into whether or not Löfving was guilty of serious misconduct. Secondly, there's the choice of investigator. So Thornberg, who was one of the people being investigated, was also the one who appointed the investigator, and he additionally appointed someone who had already investigated and cleared Thornberg once before, back when Thornberg was head of the security police during the terror attack on Drottninggatan in 2015. And this latest investigation also found that Thornberg had done nothing wrong. And even if that's true, like critics are saying that you shouldn't have an investigation where the integrity of the investigator could be called into question. Mm. And it's more a question of principle than anything else. People are not necessarily suggesting that there was anything dodgy there. Thirdly, the police are being criticised as an employer, basically, that they should have done more to like not necessarily protect living, but that even if you have an employee who's accused of misconduct, even if you have an employee who you have to dismiss ultimately, you still kind of as an employer have a responsibility to provide a sort of safety net for them. Like you shouldn't just abandon them. But instead there was this public press conference where one person who led the inquiry basically declared that Löfving was not fit to be a manager and he should be fired. And Thunberg was talking to the press about how Löfving had lied to him and so on. As far as I understand, even before talking to Löfving himself. And the criticism basically boils down to that's not the way to behave as an employer.
No. And where is the criticism coming from?
I mean, it's coming from quite a lot of directions. Löfving's family have criticised the police. The prosecutor leading the criminal investigation have criticised them. I think the police union have criticised the way the investigation's conclusions were announced as well. The police authority themselves have reported themselves to the Work Environment Authority, which is kind of the standard procedure in these cases, to see whether or not they had actually provided a safe work environment for Löfving. The Justice Minister, which is the person who's ultimately responsible for the police authority, he's been called to the Justice Committee in Parliament to answer questions about how the government handled the investigation, because there has been talk about how the government apparently pressured Thunberg a bit to make sure that this whole thing got investigated speedily.
And before Löfving's death, the Justice Minister had given his full backing to Thunberg, despite criticism from the Sweden Democrats in particular that the National Police Chief wasn't doing enough to tackle gang crime. Is the Justice Minister Gunnar Strömmer going to revise his opinion now? And if so, what will be the political ramifications for him?
So Strömmer is in a bit of a tricky position because it has in a way been very convenient for him to have Thunberg in that role. Thunberg has been police chief longer than Strömmer has been Justice Minister. He was appointed by the previous government, the Social Democrats, and his presence as police chief kind of means that a lot of the criticism that the police have been getting about gang crime tends to stick on Thunberg and kind of avoid Strömmer. Now, if he were to fire Thunberg, that criticism is going to need somewhere to land, and chances are that it's then going to land on Strömmer instead. Plus, as you said, Strömmer has backed Thunberg, so it would seem strange if he suddenly made a U-turn on that. But we'll see what happens. I mean, the other two options are that they let Thunberg stay on for another year until his current contract expires, or that he kind of gets asked a bit behind the scenes to resign on his own initiative. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
Okay, yeah, we'll see how this goes. Thanks for that explanation, Emma. On to a different story now. Last week, we spoke to the Ukrainian ambassador to mark the first anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion. And we talked quite a lot about how much Sweden has supported Ukraine. But one news item last week told an underreported story that seemed to catch a lot of people off guard. So a year to the day after the invasion, a ship docked at Nynäshamn outside Stockholm carrying Russian gas for distribution to customers in Sweden. James, were you surprised when you heard this story and why?
Well, a little. First of all, we don't usually see Sweden as a gas-dependent country. And secondly, because Sweden has been at the vanguard of efforts to cut trade ties with Russia. To look at the first point, now this gas was bought by a Finnish energy company and distributed to Swedish industrial customers for use in steelmaking, among other things. Now, so this wasn't ending up in homes. It wasn't domestic gas. Sweden doesn't use much gas for heating or cooking. But perhaps controversially, among the end users of the gas is SSAB, which is actually a state-owned Swedish steelmaker. So Russian gas being used by a Swedish state-owned company. But as for the second point, gas imports are not banned under sanctions. So it's important to note that this is not illegal. In fact, the importer Gasum, this Finnish company, says that it is bound by long-term contracts to buy the gas. So it really couldn't get out of its purchases. In a sense, it's not surprising. There are many of these deals being done around Europe, and gas is still being imported into Europe. Somewhere between 3 and 10% of the gas being used in Europe today is still Russian gas.
And do we know how much gas Sweden has imported since February last year?
Well, according to Greenpeace, which has done some research on this, almost exactly 103,000 cubic metres of gas has been imported since the invasion, all coming on ships into Sweden. And that's worth about 1.7 billion Swedish kroner. So, you know, in the grand scheme of Sweden's energy use, not a massive amount, but still not microscopic. There has been a significant amount of gas, more than just this shipment.
Yeah. So when the current government was in opposition, they pushed hard for all imports of Russian fossil fuels to be halted. Why aren't they stopping this?
Because they can't. Sanctions are decided at the EU level, so there's not much the Swedes on their own can do about it. And for the moment, gas is not covered by sanctions. Now, lots of European companies have made significant efforts to get their gas usage down, most prominently Germany. Sweden and their trade minister, Johan Forssell, is arguing that gas should be covered by sanctions. And Forssell says he's pushing that case within the EU. And already, EU nations have ended imports of Russian oil brought in by sea and have just instituted a ban on refined oil products, which came in last month. But so far, there is no ban on gas. And we'll see if that comes in the future. But clearly, there are other countries in Europe that are much more reliant on Russian gas than Sweden, even if less so than before, and who might want to stop that from happening.
Okay, great. Thanks for that roundup. And all of this does seem to highlight how hard the scramble to replace Russian energy sources has been. I saw that Reuters had a report recently showing that the Baltic states had also imported a lot of liquefied gas from Russia last year, despite being the first countries in Europe to halt imports of natural gas in April last year. So yeah, it's a complex issue.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Next, we are going to listen to an interview with Australia's ambassador to Sweden, Bernard Philip. We had a chat recently about Swedish-Australian relations, and he estimated that there are around 7,000 Australians in Sweden. And we'll join the conversation at a point where he talks about some visible signs of Australia making its mark in Sweden. And I possibly wrongly suggested that flat whites really come from New Zealand. And I should note that there was a New Zealander in the room too. So it was just a bit of fun before anyone attacks me over it. Okay, let's listen.
If you go into cafes here, and I've really noticed a change even in the last 3 years, you'll see flat white on the menu.
Yes.
And I think we sort of compete with New Zealand over responsibility for the flat white, but I'll certainly, as Australian ambassador, claim it as one of ours. You do also see, and again, comes back to the weather, quite a lot of Australian footwear here in Stockholm. So in particular, Iron Williams boots and Blundstones.
There are Blundstones everywhere.
Yeah, so I mean, there might be a bit of a divide between the sort of Iron Williams are more Östermalm and Blundstones are Södermalm, perhaps.
I don't want to cause too much of a dispute here, but I think New Zealand has won the communications battle over flat white.
Aha, uh-huh, okay, rightio. Well, we'll come back to Pavlova then in a
okay.
little while. Yeah.
Czech Republic, maybe? can you tell us a little bit about bilateral relations between Australia and Sweden?
We have a very strong relationship with Sweden. It does go back quite a long way, which I think is not appreciated as much as it could be, in that there was a Swede, Daniel Salander, mm-hmm. From Piteå, who was on board the Endeavour voyage in the late 1760s, then arriving in Australia, what's now Australia, in 1770. So he was the first, I think, European-trained scientist to ever visit Australia. and played a really critical role in the Endeavour mission in terms of discovery for Europeans of the botanical wonders of Australia. So in that sense, the connection does go back quite a way. Swedes have been coming to Australia to do business for a long time. Ericsson has been present there since 1890. And I think we have enjoyed really getting to know each other through the 20th century. We're coming up to the 50th anniversary of ABBA's famous tour of Australia in 1977. And I mean, I know growing up in the 1980s, I still have very vivid memories of the great Swedish players coming down about this time of year to play some tremendous tennis during the height of the Australian summer.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of the relationship today, certainly trade and investment ties are a very important part of our connection with Sweden and the Nordics. We benefit enormously from the capabilities and the technologies that Swedish companies bring to Australia, and we're keen to attract more investment. We're negotiating a free trade agreement between Australia and the European Union, and we hope that that will really promote stronger trade ties. There are Australian companies that are active in Sweden, whether it's building the Mall of Scandinavia or the Arlanda Express, or the largest onshore wind farm in northern Sweden. Australian companies have seen opportunities here. I suppose the areas that I'd highlight going forward would be really around the green transition.
Yeah.
I mean, Sweden is leading the world in terms of what they're doing through companies like Northvolt and SSAB in really building new industries around fossil-free steel and green batteries. And given that Australia also has a large minerals endowment, given that we have enormous potential for renewable energy, particularly solar, we think that we can learn from some of Sweden's experience and really help drive emissions reductions, not only for Australia, but for our trading partners as well. The final area I'd mention is engagement between the Sami people and Indigenous Australians. That's an area that has strengthened in recent years, and we see really good opportunities to promote closer ties between Indigenous Australians and the Sami people, particularly in areas where we all need to learn from the practices of Indigenous peoples, particularly around environmental stewardship. So that is an area of the relationship with a lot of potential.
And if we can move on a little bit to your own personal experiences of Sweden, was there anything in particular that surprised you when you moved here?
One thing that I think surprised me was the patriotism in Sweden. It's not necessarily a country you associated with sort of the stronger forms of nationalism. And I don't think that's the form of patriotism they have here. It is more of a perhaps quieter form, but it's just something that strikes you around different parts of the country. You sort of see it in the Swedish flags that are, again, out in the countryside or on boats in the Stockholm archipelago. And I think it just does reflect a strong sense of pride in Sweden's language and history and culture, and also a national cohesion.
Yeah, what's the best thing about living in Sweden, do you think?
Well, I'm sorry to bring it back to the weather, but I think it really is just the sense of relief that you get as the days start and get a bit longer, and then just the exuberance of summer. I mean, I think there are more smiling faces around, and having been through now, or nearly through four winters, you can kind of sense why that exuberance is there. I suppose the follow-on benefit perhaps for my family is that we will never really complain about cold weather in Canberra, Australia's capital again. Yeah. I mean, we're seasoned Arctic people now, I think, as regards the weather. So back in Australia, we're going to be well equipped.
That was Australia's Ambassador Bernard Phillip. And we will have more from that interview in an article on the site in the coming days. On to a language issue now, and you may well have noticed that often staff in cafes and restaurants will only take orders in English. A reader of the newspaper Svenska Dagbladet was sufficiently annoyed by this phenomenon to write to the paper's etiquette columnist Sofia Larsson recently and ask if English is now the norm in Stockholm. We're going to talk to our panellists in a few minutes about the importance of speaking Swedish, but first I caught up with Sofia to see how she responded to that reader's query. Let's listen to what she had to say.
Actually, this was One of the hardest questions for me to answer when I got it to my column, because sometimes the answer is so easy, but there's a lot of factors that you have to weigh in here, and not all people are the same. For example, I had a colleague and she seemed to be like an outgoing social person, but she had a lot of issues. Like if you were supposed to meet her outside a restaurant, she made sure that she wasn't the first to go there because she got super nervous. And I also know that she had a lot of issues with speaking English. So for her, this would be an actual issue. So we have to always like remember that we are different and different people have different needs. So just like be a little bit, you know, kind to each other.
You touch on this in the column that maybe the staff member should make the first move and communicate that they don't speak Swedish.
I mean, that is a nice thing to do. So you don't ramble blah, 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 blah in Swedish. And then after that, they say like, well, I only speak English, so I didn't understand a word of what you were saying. Like,
yeah.
They should do a little nice and courteous interruption, like within the first couple of words.
So do you understand why some people find it annoying?
Well, I mean, there's at least two sides to everything. And is it reasonable that you will be able to make yourself understood and understand other people in your own language in the country that you live in? Yes. But is English also a very universal language that most people know of? Suddenly I feel like I are bad at English, and that's a bit funny. The thing is that you don't want to be caught off guard, I think. I mean, before we did this interview, you eased me in a little bit and talked about like this topics that I was familiar, like where I grew up and stuff. And
yeah.
I mean, that is the way to do it. Like, don't surprise people. And I mean, there are places that you might go, like if you go to a pub that's called the Crazy Kangaroo, then you understand that, oh, I might have to talk English to the bartender there.
Yeah, probably.
But there are other places where you might be surprised. And there are also different like part of customer groups that it could be an old Swedish person, mm-hmm. or it could be a newly arrived person from a area of the world that where it's just not interesting to learn English. It has a cultural and like a geographic situation where English is not viewed as it is here in Sweden. So to not exclude people, I think that you always have to have a backup. You could always have someone you can refer to for those people who are not confident with speaking English. It's also because we are talking about lots about cafes, restaurants, and shops, like where service is important. And there can be people who are not very accommodating, even though you speak the same language. I think when those people, like to top it off, speak English, then you can perceive it as them being like a bit snotty, you know? But there can also be people that they could speak like a language that has been dead for thousands of years, and you would still be like, wow, this person is so nice. I feel so welcome here. So it has a lot to do about like the energy that you put in behind the words. And people, they want to usually understand each other, and they find a way to communicate. And usually you don't talk about quantum physics in shops and restaurants. So yeah, I think that you shouldn't like overestimate how big this problem is.
Do you think that maybe people working in cafes and restaurants should learn the basics to be able to communicate with customers in Swedish?
I mean, that is absolutely welcome, for sure.
Yeah.
And when I got this question in the column that I'm writing, then the person who asked if it was a good idea that people have a little pin or something that shows what language they're speaking, and that's very proactive. And proactive, I think, is good in this situation.
Do you personally find it annoying if you place an order for a coffee, for example, and the person replies that they don't speak Swedish, and can you ask again in English?
No, not really. I'm usually happy to speak English. I think it's fun. But like I said before, right now I feel like I'm much worse in my English than I'm usually. I'm speaking Swenglish or something. I guess that's because I speak about subjects that I don't speak about in everyday life. So I have to think more and then it doesn't flow. But I am confident to order a coffee in English for sure.
Yeah, but your English is really good, and I understand that you're just coming into this situation having maybe not spoken English for a while. But isn't this the point that your English is excellent and most Swedes' English is excellent, and that's why this situation can happen?
Yes,
and that kind of goes back to what you were saying, that maybe we shouldn't overestimate the problem, right?
Exactly, and I think after the. I mean, everyone has heard about how hard it is to find staff for these kind of areas, like restaurants, and they can't recruit people who know perfect Swedish. It's also like a Euro thing, like a lot of Spanish people or Portuguese people will come here and it's just a new situation.
That was Sofia Larsson, who, apart from writing for Svenska Dagbladet, is also the author of a book on modern etiquette. And we heard Sofia say there that while the prevalence of English might be irritating for some people, it's also not a massive deal as long as everyone can understand each other. Is that a fair point?
Yeah, I mean, in a sense. I think we've got to remember, though, that there's a... As Sofia was talking about, there is a huge span of people in Sweden and they have different relationships to English. Now, I know a lot of people who find speaking English difficult. We think that all Swedes speak great English, and frankly, most of them do.
Yeah.
But even some of those people who speak decent enough English don't feel that comfortable speaking it and find it inhibiting, and it makes them insecure. So I think, if you're going around Stockholm or Sweden and you're working in a public-facing job and you're speaking English to people, don't take for granted that they are going to feel comfortable speaking to you in English, because a lot of people, even if they will try and they will try and hide their embarrassment or discomfort, actually don't find it that comfortable.
What I don't understand is why, like, if you're not comfortable speaking English, then don't speak English. Why can't just one person speak English and the other person speak Swedish, and you might not understand each other completely, but you can use hand gestures and you'll be able to tell from each other's tone whether you're being friendly or not. And it'll be a bit awkward, but just let it be awkward.
What slightly gets me in some of these situations, when I'm sitting there with a bunch of Swedish people, we're all talking Swedish, and then you're asked to order in English, is when there's no effort on the part of the waiter, I think, to speak any kind of Swedish. I think a little bit of Swedish goes a long way in those kind of situations. And, an announcement, look, I'm still learning Swedish, but, hey and a tack, and trying to understand the basics of menu Swedish doesn't take very long.
I've sometimes been spoken to in English by Swedish staff at restaurants in Stockholm. I don't know if that's because I have a southern Swedish accent or if it's just that they're so used to dealing with tourists that their brain sometimes just switches.
I was reading an interview a few days ago with a Ukrainian woman who moved here sometime early last year, and she was working in a hotel on the outskirts of Stockholm. And she said that the working language there at the hotel is English. And that kind of surprised me, because you think of English being the working language for tech companies, but maybe that's seeping more into the service industry as well.
I think very much so, because, it's very clear that the service sector in Sweden is in desperate need of staff. It's very, very hard to find enough people to staff hotels and restaurants and all the other businesses that in the service sector. So they need to find people from all around the world. And as we're saying, if people have just arrived in Sweden, there's no hope of them being able to communicate with each other in Swedish. So yes, the working language in these places has to be English.
I think that there's one more aspect to all of this for me, which is that sort of a more multilingual Sweden, where a lot of people speak English and English is very prevalent in restaurants and also at other places like workplaces and universities and so on. Like, in a way, it makes Sweden more open because it's easier to come here as an English-speaking immigrant and just get by. In another way, it makes it more closed to a lot of people because not everybody around the world speaks English. does the expectation almost become that if you move to Sweden and you don't speak English, you're going to end up having to learn two languages? Both Swedish and English to be able to exist in Swedish society.
That's a really big, I mean, we know quite a few of the sort of ensam commander people, you know, the Afghans who came in 2015, and, you know, they've managed to get, you know, absolutely perfect Swedish, but they don't speak English. You know, there's a lot of immigrants who the effort of learning fluent Swedish crowds out learning English.
It can be very excluding, but there's still a lot of older Swedes, you know, native-born Swedes who find English very difficult as well.
How important do you think it is to learn Swedish if you live in Sweden? I mean, has this transformation changed the equation in any way?
I think it really depends on what your plans are for Sweden. I mean, if you're coming here to work for 3 years at Spotify as part of a kind of international career, I think you could get by, have a perfectly nice time here only speaking English, and I don't think your experience would be much worse if you didn't get to grips with Swedish. And the same with if you're like a teacher at a university or a lecturer at a university or something like that. But I think if you want to kind of get below the surface and feel comfortable in the society, I think it's really important to learn Swedish.
I mean, it's really difficult for a lot of people to learn Swedish. Also, like, for example, if you work as a doctoral student at university, you've got quite a busy schedule, so it's hard to fit in Swedish lessons on the side. You also work in an international environment, so you don't get a lot of opportunity to practice.
I mean, one thing I kind of wish I'd done, and I would recommend to people who come here as a kind of love refugee, and they're thinking, well, I'm going to settle here, I'm going to have a family here, I'm going to be here for a decade. The people I know who've done these intensive Swedish courses at the big universities, where you take a year of your life where you don't work and you just hammer it. I think there's a real advantage to doing that, because then when you finish that and you step into society, you've already got over the threshold where you can speak to people and they won't switch back to English.
One of the things that a lot of linguists talk about in this context is the question of domain loss, where languages like Swedish, you know, basically non-English languages, stop being used in certain environments. I mean, we've already seen it to a large extent in academia, in universities, particularly in many sort of scientific subjects. Swedish is barely used. Academic papers are hardly ever written in languages like Swedish, or frankly, in most other non-English languages. And, you know, there's a concern among some linguists, among, I guess, some people for whom preserving linguistic diversity is important, that this is going to spread and going to move into more areas. And, you know, you can understand their concern, because obviously a language is a bearer of culture, it's a bearer of tradition, it's a bearer of people's, also of individuals' personalities. If you are, if something is your native language, you perhaps feel that you can express yourself much more fluently in it. And I think that that's something for us, for those of us who come in from other countries and speak English in Swedish society, to at least bear in mind that there are sensitivities around this that aren't just about whether people understand you. It's also about a desire to protect the sort of culture and the language that bears it.
For anyone who wants more good tips on learning Swedish, by the way, I recommend listening to our episode from April 9th last year, where we had Swedish teacher Sofie Tegsveden-Devo in the studio, and we'll link to that episode in the notes if you want to find it quickly. So that's all for today. Thanks, as always, to our members, whose support is what makes this podcast happen. If you like the podcast and you have a moment, please help us get the word out by leaving a review or rating it or sharing it with people you think might enjoy it. And do make sure to follow the podcast in your app so you get new episodes delivered as soon as they go live. Our panelists today were James Savage, Emma Lovegrain, and Richard Orange. Our sound engineer is Rhys Edwards. I'm Paul O'Mahony, and we'll be back again next Saturday. Until then, take care.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
That's all for this week's free edition of Sweden in Focus. If you'd like to hear a full-length version of the podcast each week, as well as an additional midweek episode with more interviews and analysis, please upgrade to Membership Plus. Make sure to check the episode notes for details on how to upgrade. Sweden in Focus is a podcast by The Local Europe. Our sound engineer is Rhys Edwards. The publisher is James Savage.